When I asked you why you didn't want to reprint or republish the article on Jewish slavery and emancipation, you said, en passant, well, you know, this metaphor of henchmen, it can be said and not written. You remember? It would.
I didn't say that. I said that's what Keith Joseph said.
Ah, I see.
Not I. No, no. I see. He said you can call. He read it. In the Jewish Chronicle, he said you can say the Jews are hunchbacks, but you can't write it. That's after he read it already.
That Keith Joseph said.
No, I never said that.
No, I
didn't reprint it because I thought it would produce a row.
Yeah,
a lot of Jews will object to being described as such.
Yeah.
Well, it's exaggerated and so on. I mean, Zionism all very well, but it's not true, they're not like that. And anyhow, that'll produce, obviously, rather offensive. When it was printed in France, it did not produce, it was reviewed with extreme coolness.
Cool.
Oh yes, it wasn't liked. No friend Jew wants to be told that he's something is wrong with him. Maybe the anti-Semites are wrong to accuse him, but that he has certain qualities which can be accused, that's not acceptable.
Now, my question is now not the content, but something.
Some qualities which can be, yes, which can be objected to. I mean, yes. Sorry. Yes.
No, it's all right. Now, you use so many metaphors in your lectures and writings.
Yes.
So many.
Yes.
Are they prepared in advance?
No.
I mean, no.
I'll tell you why. If you want to know how I lecture, I will tell you.
Yes, I will.
I'm the most nervous lecturer you ever met. Before every lecture, I've never enjoyed delivering a lecture in my life. I have lectured, you know, since 1934, I should think. 1934. And I've lectured until my voice gave, which was about 5 years ago. And so I must have delivered a very great many lectures in my life. Here in America and other countries. I've never enjoyed a lecture in my life. I'm a nervous lecturer. I'm never sure what I'm going to say, so I prepare each lecture with extreme care. And each lecture I probably write about 40 pages of notes. These I boil down to about 6 pages. And these I boil down to 1 page, with headlines mainly, in case I forget. Just in order, in case I'm struck by aphasia. When I actually deliver the lecture, I don't look at the notes. I look straight in front of me, to the top right-hand corner. I cannot look at a human face. I have no rapport with the audience of any kind. I have no idea whether they like it, they don't like it. Not an idea, because I'm much too frightened. I'm rather like somebody crossing Niagara on a very narrow bridge with, I don't know, sharks on one side and tigers on the other. And all I want is not to fall off. And all I want is to get to the end, for the hour to be over. That's all I want. I'm never quite clear what I'm going to say next. And my habit is to repeat everything in various tones and forms. Hence the similes. Similes come because my natural way of speaking is to repeat everything 3 times. Right or wrong, it annoys some people. It pleases others because they can get it down, because they can get hold of what I'm saying. Each time differently. And in order to say it differently, of course, that does mean the different similes and different images are employed. At the end of the lecture, I always feel it's been a failure, now they can see through me. I'm obviously a charlatan, and the game is up. Since I feel equal degree of shame after every lecture I've ever delivered, and some of my lectures must be worse than others, it must be a neurotic symptom. When people say nice things to me after a lecture, which occasionally happens, I don't believe a word they say, but I'm very grateful to them for being so nice to me. I feel I'm flattered by being flattered, but I feel it is probably flattery. Just nicenesses, just being agreeable because they like me or they want to put me out of my misery or whatever it is. But I don't believe a word, you see. I never have. And so I'm told sometimes I'm a good lecturer, etc. The real reason is that because I'm so terrified, a certain intensity enters my voice, simply through terror. And that does communicate itself to the audience because there's a kind of tension without which no lectures are ever a success. All lectures are forms of acting on the stage, inevitably. Now, there is a paradox about lecturing, which I've always been aware of. It takes two gifts which are incompatible with each other. One of the great examples of fundamental incompatibility between values, which I've preached all my life. One is that you need to know what you're doing, what you're talking about. You need to be a quiet scholar in the study, accumulating material, thinking above all, in a peaceful and orderly way, in order to arrive at what it is you want to say to the public. Privately, you can think anything you like. But if you're going to talk in public, you must have some responsibility for the truth or validity of what you believe you are saying. At least some respect for, and I mean, you must believe in the truth or the validity to some degree. And if you have doubts, you must express those now. The second gift is that of a ham actor. The two gifts don't go together. So there is always a certain conflict between the desire to be precise and to have thought properly and to know what you're going to say, and the ham actor part, which invariably exaggerates, goes too far, repeats itself too often, uses too many images, and mainly wants to impress the audience. Those two gifts don't combine. That is true of all lecturers at all times. So it's Socrates talking to a few disciples, but a man on the platform. I always feel it's an unnatural situation for one man to be talking and everybody else to be silent. Seminars I don't mind so much. People can interrupt. Once they ask questions, I'm liberated. I like to talk freely. But on the lecture platform, I'm in a state of agony. So you say about metaphors, etc., that's because of a habit of repetition, which I think may be natural to me anyway, because I'm so talkative, but particularly stimulated by the need to convey what I want to say in more than one brief sentence. I don't read from notes. I've done it in the case of rather pompous, what's called important lectures, where I want to get it right. The inaugural lecture, for example, when I became professor, was read. The Baura lecture, which was about Moscow and so on, was read only because my voice had given already, and I didn't want to risk anything. I thought if I read it in even voice, it would be less of a strain on my vocal cord, which was paralyzed. But otherwise, I didn't read.
No.
On the radio, for example, I've delivered two courses of talks, each of an hour long, 12 hours, 12 lectures, 12 hours. I could never look at a note. And some of them slopped over somewhere an hour and a quarter, so that was too long, around 20 minutes, so that I had to do again. But I did it again without looking at notes.
You prefer it again to writing the paper?
I can't talk from paper. It sounds dead. It's dead.
No.
If I read from paper, it's exactly like reading minutes of a written by another secretary.
Now, so the metaphors are invented during the lecture.
Oh yes, in a positive, absolutely. Ambulando. Not prepared.
Let's say if somebody afterwards reads your lecture. And there is a sentence like this. I mean, when you discover thinking, you said to interpret, to classify, to symbolize, to relate, and you don't say to analyze. Now, is it deliberate?
No.
Or just by chance?
No, whatever comes to my head. It's absolutely spontaneous. Sometimes it comes out wrong, but it is spontaneous.
Now, when you read your lecture afterwards,
I don't read it. What do you mean? It's not written down. If it's published, if I get a transcript, then I'm horrified. Then I'm invariably horrified. I think it's too awful. I do the same thing when I dictate articles for the few, or even dictate the kind of lectures I am going to read. I dictate them first. The secretary takes them down. I mean, does it from the machine into which I dictate, and then she gives me the transcript. I look on it like an essay by a bad pupil. Every sentence seems wrong to me. I correct it totally. I cross everything out. And I rewrite. But the basic pattern, of course, remains the same. I don't completely rewrite it. I simply correct it.
Yes, you don't rewrite.
No.
Because it has the flair of...
Oh, something is spoken, I know. Yes. No, it's already... There's a fatal given form, which I don't alter. Yes. I don't start again. I eliminate some things and I correct them, and then a second version. And I cross that out too. And that could go on indefinitely. Because there's nothing I hate more than looking at things I've written myself. They always seem wrong to me afterwards. I haven't conveyed it. What was I thinking of? Why did I say this? Sometimes I'm caught out. A Soviet scholar arrived the other day. And... he's an authority on Tolstoy and on other things. Very learned man called Luria, an elderly Jewish Russian historian of literature. Extremely learned, very, very accurate and impressive. He read my piece on Tolstoy, and in one of the footnotes, I say that the historical views of Tolstoy have been compared with those of Kautsky, Lenin, and Stalin. And at this point I say that this belongs to the realm of politics or theology. Then my friend, or at least my visitor, said that where exactly was it so compared? I was unable to say. I was unable to say because obviously Soviet books wouldn't be likely to talk about Kautsky. He said it's impossible that anyone in the Soviet Union could ever have compared Tolstoy's views to those of Lenin or Stalin, because Tolstoy's historical views are totally denied. Not a single one of them even begins to be accepted to this day. He was not a materialist. His theories of history are quite wrong, and therefore... And Lenin delivered a famous essay about him called Tolstoy Mirror of the Revolution, which made it plain that all this is to be rejected. And therefore, there cannot have been any Soviet scholar who could have compared it even in a derogatory fashion. So where did it come from? I had no idea. I referred him to, I think, an American writer whom I hoped it might have come, but I had no memory of it. That's what I mean by saying a certain unscholarliness. I don't give sufficient references. When my friends edited my odd essays in four, which appeared in four little paperbacks, and the fifth is about to appear, I'm told, apparently yes, sometime, if I allow them. First of all, I don't give footnotes. It comes from lectures. Secondly, when I do give them, they're often wrong. So they've had terrible labors in order to trace them and identify the references. Sometimes they couldn't be found. In that case, the footnotes were crossed out. The references were crossed out. They were put in indirect speech. I mean, I put things in inverted commas and then never to discover. So I am afraid I have a somewhat creative memory, which sometimes invents and distorts.
I
am very inaccurate. I am very inaccurate, yes. I remember things in general, but not in particular. So sometimes I get it wrong. And for example, I was absolutely sure that Montesquieu talked about the danger of les grands simplificateurs, the great simplifiers. There's nothing about that in Montesquieu. But I think it is probably produced by men about Montesquieu, namely somebody in the 19th century who wrote about him. I think Sainte-Beuve, in fact, used it. But I was quite clear that one of the central doctrines of Montesquieu's fear of the great simplifiers. It's fundamentally correct about Montesquieu, but he didn't use the words.
No, what is going to, the fifth volume is going to be around a certain...
No. Just a collection, I don't know, I suppose we'll have to invent some kind of unifying title.
Lectures, later lectures?
Later pieces, printed pieces. Yes. I can't remember what they are. There are one or two things which I never had printed before about Romanticism. Some lecture I delivered in Japan, lecture I delivered in Venice, that sort of thing. And there's a piece on about Edmund Wilson in Oxford, which is a comical piece. And there is, of course, the Agnelli lecture in Turin. The last one, that would go in. And then they keep on pressing me to give my manuscript a demestre. I wrote a huge piece. It was never published. It's confused. It's too long. Well, it was too long. I did send it to the Journalist of Ideas, which said it was too repetitive and too long. And so I just threw it away. But it may exist in some of my manuscript. TypeScript, well, they can get on with it if they like. I can do nothing to it.
Is there an editor of this volume?
Yes, there will be, yes.
Will
you? Well, Henry Hardy, I suppose.
Done
entirely by Henry Hardy. He was the editor. Other people wrote introductions.
How were those written the introduction?
He was helped, of course, Henry Hardy, by some of the people who wrote the introductions, who were very good about this.
I was going to ask. We discussed Noel Annan introduction, but the three others.
The first was on the Russian thinkers, was Aileen Kelly. She certainly helped to trace some of the references.
I'm sorry.
She worked with Hardy, very devotedly. I was very grateful to her. She did quite a lot for me. She says I did a lot for her, but if so, it was handsomely repaid. That's one. The next one was...
You liked the introduction?
I did. Well, there were certain things within it which I had to remove because it was too extravagant. The praise was a little too extravagant. It went a little too far. I begged her to take it out. I thought it would seem ridiculous to the reader, not only to me. And then the next one was done by Bernard Williams, who was very generous of me to offer it. I didn't correct a word of that.
It was excellent.
I know. He's a very good. He's a very good philosopher, and a very good friend, and a very good friend.
Who picked him up?
I don't know. I cannot remember. I don't think so. I think Hardy probably suggested him, among others.
It was really.
Absolutely, I agree. And it got it right, It's, my views are correctly stated, yes. The third volume was a man called Hausherr, he calls himself. I don't know what he's by origin, Swiss, I think. He's a graduate student at Wolfson, and he's a German scholar. And he's a student of Fichte, and he's been writing a doctorate thesis for about 20 years now. It has never been presented. A very nice very intelligent man, great friend of Hardy in Wolfson. We were there together. And he really knows my works through and through. And I'm sure he'll want to write something about me after I'm dead as well. I have a feeling that he's accumulating material. He'll probably help with the last volume too. Because he's a kind of disciple. I think he's the only disciple I've ever had.
Really?
I think so. I've never had disciples.
Yes, you
never.
I understand why. So how come that he's the only disciple?
Can't tell you, I never know. He suddenly began coming to me and listening to what I said and discussing. It obviously made some impression on him. That's all I can say.
No, I thought that it's not, I mean, when you said that you had disciples, that you were quite...
Well, I don't want them, no. No. I hate accepting responsibility for people, in general. I have a certain fear of influencing people. I always hope not to. When people say they were influenced by me and so on, it causes me to a certain reaction. I always wonder whether it's for their good or what they've derived. The last thing I want is to have a following.
Now, Hauser's introduction is very good, but very Germanic.
Well, certainly. I think he must have German blood in him. He's a German scholar, of course.
Anyway,
that's where he got his degree in.
Here
at St. Catherine's.
Heavy.
It's heavy, yes, but it's correct.
Sure.
That's all I ask for.
Yeah.
All that was wrong with Noel Annan was that it bore no relation to many things and to the facts.
Now, when speaking about students...
Noel Annan is writing a book at the moment. It's about
who?
Noel Annan is about to produce a book called Our Age. It'll say some very interesting, very intelligent things, and some rather odd things too. Part two.
Yes. Kind of sociological.
He writes very well. He writes very well. He writes very well. His reviews in New York were excellent, but it's hit and miss. Sometimes he gets his seat, sometimes it works, sometimes not quite.
Coming back to your students, generally speaking, I mean, the graduate students that you had, did you anticipate the future correctly? I mean, did your evaluation of them was proved to be right?
Yes, on the whole, it's a very conceited thing to say.
No.
I'm quite a good judge of form. Quite a good judge of quality, yes. On the whole, I anticipated correctly. I mean, what kind of degrees they'd get. And not what would happen in the future afterlife, but roughly what their quality was appeared to me to be verified by their future careers, experiences. Gone?
No.
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 You were
saying. No.
In the last meeting we spoke about social science.
Well, to interrupt, I wasn't a very good tutor. I mean, in the case of very clever, of course, I liked clever people to argue with and so on, but I wasn't very good. Because I was too easily bored by rather conventional work, and I wasn't conscientious enough in the way in which say Herbert Hart was, of really looking at what they're saying and carefully arguing in a rational manner for what I thought to be right and what I thought was mistaken in that case. I talked too much at them. I mean, I may have influenced them by telling them. I didn't examine their theses, perhaps, minutely enough, and sometimes I dismissed them too rapidly and too easily. Some of my pupils, I think, probably bear a certain grudge for that to this day, of knocking out, knocking down what they said, and putting nothing in its place, of which I have a certain tendency. What I was accused of, and I think rightly, was whenever anyone said anything, I said, oh yes, there's nothing new in that. So-and-so said that. Oh, well, you'll find it. And so oh, well, yes. Yes, that's an old idea. Yes. And so on. That's obviously irritating. Instead of doing what my colleague David Settle said, oh, very interesting you should say that. That's very, very interesting. Do develop that a little. Oh, I'm very, very, oh, very, that's very good. Because it would encourage them immensely. I think, on the whole, I was a discouraging and not an encouraging tutor. So I became, but when I became professor, it was probably to relieve, not relieve, it probably save people from unnecessary neglect and unnecessary criticism.
But you were supervising when you were a professor.
Oh yes, and supervision is different. That I could read long pieces by already qualified people, and I would go into that very, very well. Well, like this last girl I supervised, it. Yes, I really did take trouble. I can do that. If the thing is, if the thing is worthwhile, I've done it to quite a lot of graduate students. I've been over those theses, yes.
No, chapters,
certainly.
I was thinking mainly about...
Graduates, that's different. And if they produce long written material, I mean, written material carefully done, then I'm all right. And on the whole, they are very generous in acknowledging their debts. And that book's published. I've written lots of introductions to books too. That's my speciality. I've stopped doing it. Thank God.
When we spoke about social sciences and social studies, if I'm not mistaken, you said that, well, economics is quite
serious subject. Intellectually demanding.
And economists are clever. Clever people deal with it.
No, it was intellectually demanding.
Intellectually
demanding. That's all I'm saying.
But I thought I detected you were saying that those who are or deal with sociology or even political theory.
Not so much political theory. I did, yes, not political theory. Politics in general. Political science, you called. Yes, I believe that, yes.
Now, so what did you mean not clever?
That the subject is not intellectually demanding. That not very clever people appear to do it at the level at which it is expected of them. Just that. In other words, I'll tell you something very simple. When I examined in PPE, there were three principal subjects. One was philosophy, one was economics, one was politics. Now, if a man got an alpha mark in logic, whatever other marks he got somewhere else, there was something first rate about him. He might not get a first if he fell down on the other things, but if a man got an alpha in logic, he had in some first-class quality. If you got an alpha in economic theory, you had some first-class quality. There was no paper in politics about which this could be said. There was no way of being first-class. In political theory, yes, because it's a branch of philosophy, straightforwardly. But someone who writes about political institutions, there's no first-class way. So far, for 3 years I examined in that. There was never anybody, whether specialists or not. When what I mean is the examiner, my fellow examiners, including the politics examiners, would take notice of an alpha in logic and alpha in economic theory, and alpha in politics didn't count for nearly so much. There must have been some reason for this.
Yes.
Sociology wasn't part of the school, but applies to it even more. I think I've delivered a lecture to about sociology.
Not a lecture. No.
Well, let me tell you now. It may take 10 minutes.
Yeah, it is.
I warn you.
I mean, you spoke about it, but I prefer it.
There are two kinds of sociology. There is what might be called empirical sociology. That means if you want to know how many bearded men are likely to live to the age of 70 in Sheffield, this can probably be calculated quite well on the basis of statistical data and other relevant facts that you may collect in the way in which actuaries work in banks for insurance purposes, or accidents can be calculated roughly, number of persons killed on the roads in given situations. But it goes a little further. Descriptive sociology is all right. You can give a description of people's relationships in the society, probably with a certain degree of accuracy and a certain degree of skill and reliability and truth. Then there is a grander kind of sociology, which discovers general propositions about the nature of human societies, and therefore is able to, in theory, calls itself a science, because if you know enough facts and you know a sufficient number of laws which such persons claim to have discovered, one can presumably predict some of the future and retrodict some of the past. Now the other, the two first types, namely what might be called the kind of sociology useful to governments, political parties, commercial firms, and that this kind of organizations, that is absolutely okay. There's no reason to be against it. It's a perfectly genuine subject of a socially extremely useful kind. And provided sociology is there, I've nothing against it. But that is not intellectually demanding any more than actuaries or statistics of the kind used by these firms is intellectually too demanding. So it seems to me. Now, the descriptive sociology is good because it probably can analyze quite well the behavior of social groups and the interplay between them. So that the sociological approach to history or to politics or to, I don't know, geography, improves these subjects in the way in which mustard or salt can improve dishes. But taken neat, it doesn't work. That's my thesis. I'm in favor of sociological admixture, so to speak. I mean, so to speak, it undoubtedly, people influenced by sociology, like the French Arnal school, certainly has done good work. Now, the grand sociology, there have been some men of great talent who did that. For example,
it is intellectually demanding, but...
Well, the demand can't permit his point. The point is this. The great sociologists are, who shall we say, Montesquieu. Montesquieu is always regarded as a father. Karl Marx is a sociologist, or he's nothing. That's how he ought to be described. His economics, I don't understand. I know nothing about economics, so I don't know if that's a value. Sociology obviously is. Saint-Simon is a sociologist. He predicted, for example, technocracy. Fourier discovered the contradictions of the capitalist system. Burckhardt predicted the military-industrial complex. Karl Marx predicted big business. I'm going like that. Now, the great 19th century sociologists of a systematic kind were Marx, Weber, Durkheim. They did not learn sociology. Marx studied law and philosophy. Durkheim studied philosophy, and Weber studied history. From there, they advanced in interesting ways, and it seems to me that in the 20th century, there's been nobody of comparable quality. Maybe Marcel Mauss, the son-in-law of Durkheim, made some contribution. And there was a German accountant who wrote about money, who was a man who never got a proper chair in Berlin because he was a Jew. I can't remember his name. Sampers.
Karl
Mannheim? No, no. No, Mannheim again. Mannheim did contribute some ideas. Of course, I don't hold to them. He was a Marxist sociologist. Mannheim was quite an able man. Now, let me tell you about that. People like that, was one divided into two types. Either it's common sense. This guy is, it's written in, wrapped up in quasi-scientific language, or it's gobbledygook. It's just the, simply the, what the French call cliquetis de formule, simply the clicking of formulae, one over the other, an enormous vocabulary, which were, so to speak, one proposition takes in the dirty linen of another proposition, so to speak. That's what fundamentally our modern grand sociologists of the Parsonite type seem to me to be. Parsonism, I knew, was an absolutely honest, an extremely honorable, nice, and learned man, but he was a man of very, very dull intellect, dull imagination, very decent. But I never could conceive that a man like that could have made a bold, a sort of contribution to the subject which really would make a difference to what we thought about the world. I fear that some of his disciples, whose names I will not mention. In other words, bright ideas. Take Remarron, professor of sociology. He was an extremely clever man, by any account. He was a wonderful political analyst. Wrote extremely good analyses of contemporary French politics. His book on the French, on the German school of philosophy of history is a very second-rate book. His book on sociology is a very second-rate book. His own books of a sociological kind are extremely intelligent, are very readable, but any highly competent publicist could do that. I mean, as a publicist, the first order, you don't need training in a discipline to achieve these results. You need clarity, training in some discipline, but not that discipline. And general powers of observation, intelligence, and analysis, which are very good things. But there isn't, so to speak, a science there. There's some kind of technique, maybe, I don't know. That's what I mean by saying that when one hears of somebody as being a sociologist, one does not immediately or automatically respect them. The same is up after point two about politics too. Yes. I mean, unless there's a large infusion of history, it doesn't work. There was certainly at least one Oxford political student of politics who hated the idea of introducing history. That was the late Harrison, history at Queen's. The fellow then became professor somewhere. I think somewhere like, was it Kiel perhaps? I don't know.
In
the north, yes. Maybe someone else. He thought that politics is an independent subject. And, well, I think we are. Who was a very, very intelligent man, with Professor Robert here, wrote extremely well on constitutions. Huh? Kenneth Weir.
Well,
W-H-E-A-R-E, the Vice Chancellor. Highly intelligent man, and wrote good books.
Yes,
wrote a good book on the Statute of Westminster. He wrote a book on committees. Well, that was done by any highly intelligent man could do what he did. And he was exactly that. In the old days, they were called publicists. Morley was a man like that in the 19th century. Who wrote a book on compromise.
Bagot?
Badgett, yes. Nice guy called him Badgett. Some people call him Bagot. Badgett. Yes, I'm through to a very, very gifted, remarkable. He didn't call himself a sociologist. Nor did anybody else call him that. Oh, yes. First rate.
Yes.
I mean, great. Herzen was a publicist of that kind. Said very, very intelligent things, which sociologists would do well to mark. Very good.
Again, if I got it correctly, when you said that...
What I really mean is this, that distinction in sociology is compatible with industry, lucidity, passion of the subject, some powers of analysis, and stupidity. None of these qualities contradict each other. This is not true of scientific subjects.
Yes. All right. Now, when you appeal to when the chair of political
theory was social and political theory, it was created after the war.
I first created it on
the opinion. Yes, absolutely. Before that, it was combined with political institutions. But the people who held it knew nothing about political theory. I mean, the first holder, can't remember, before the war, before the First World War. No, I think maybe the first holder. The Gladstone Church was called. I think the first holder was probably Adams, became born in All Souls. He was the Lord George, the Secretary for Agriculture. In the First World War, he knew a lot about blue books. He had very considerable, but he didn't know a word of political theory. He was succeeded by Salter, whose knowledge of political theory was sub-zero. Then came the war, and then came Kohl. The chair was divided into two. Weir took one chair, Kohl took the other. They were both excellent professors.
They were both?
Excellent professors.
Kohl and?
Weir. Exactly what happened. Divided into political institutions and political theory.
Now, you appeal, you apply for the job, you said, because of the problems you had when you were a research fellow, you didn't want to be pressed. Are you writing, are you not writing, are you publishing, you know?
No, because I wanted a little, maybe a little more harsh towards myself. Yes. That's why I became a fellow of New College for that purpose, not professor. I became a fellow of New College in 1938. When I was a research fellow of All Souls then. In order not, I published a book on Karl Marx, but I didn't want to be constantly scrutinized about whether my research was going well or badly and how much I wrote. I did write one or two other things, even including the book, but I didn't want to be, I just wanted to teach, and then what I do the rest of my time is my own affair. That was when I became 38. I applied for the chair, then I came back to All Souls as a research fellow. By this time I published a certain amount of, some of them were all lectures, all articles. Not a book, certainly. I never did publish a book after that. But then, my reason for wanting to be a professor, partly, as you say, because I didn't want to be told to breathe down my neck, but mainly not that. Mainly because I wanted discipline. I thought I might be idle. I might waste time, because I have a great tendency to sort of enjoyment. I don't like work. Whenever all the work I've done in my life, comes from shame about not doing work. And therefore I needed some kind of discipline, some institution, yes, to make me do certain things. 2 lectures a week, 2 terms, that meant that I worked very hard and didn't publish very little. Because once I delivered the lecture, I threw away the notes. Which in a way was a waste. But I always did that. Because I couldn't bear the thought of this kind of thing. I thought that, as I told you, each lecture was to be no good, and therefore the notes were worthless. I've wasted a great deal of writing in that way. I could have, as far as pages are concerned, I could have produced thousands and thousands of pages of written documents if I had preserved my notes. I've suffered from a certain degree of self-contempt. Self-contempt and lack of self-confidence, which is a permanent characteristic of mine to this day.
You said it to me.
What?
I know that you think so.
Yes. I think it's true. I have a certain lack of confidence, self-confidence. That's genuinely true. Otherwise, I wouldn't be nervous all the time with that kind of thing.
No, you don't appear to be nervous.
I know, but that's part of the acting. That's part of the ham acting, ham actor part.
But still, your close friends know...
I have no idea what they know.
You've never discussed it?
Never, no. No, I never discussed my own character. Much. It's not a subject which I take to great interest. There are people who do, but I'm not very self-interested.
And then you...
It's part of my lack of confidence. I think that my personality is not worth discussing by myself or anyone else. If I know it, someone else does, I become worried. I don't like the thought that someone's writing about me, favorably or unfavorably.
Now, when you, after some years, you were bored in the chair.
Yes.
And you said another sentence that intrigued me. You said, well, the professor ought to be involved.
Yes.
Currently, what do you really have in mind?
Just that. That if you're talking about political theory, if you're not interested in the arguments and the issues which go on in your own time, but confine yourself to the description and analysis of theories held in the past, you are not worth your chair. You shouldn't hold it. Any art historian who has no interest in contemporary art at all shouldn't write art history. He may produce quite useful work, but fundamentally something suspicious about a man who is interested in art, but never in any contemporary art. And I felt exactly that. Now, when the Vietnam War occurred, there was a book published of various people's opinions. It was a model on a book during the Spanish Civil War, when, as you can imagine, the left supported the Republic, and Evelyn Waugh, Roy Campbell, was a right-wing poet, and so on, I mean, made the opposite statements, all right. A man called Wolfe, who was the nephew of Leonard Wolfe, I can't remember his first name, decided to publish a book like that, Opinions about the Vietnam War. I was asked to contribute. I absolutely hated doing it, because I didn't have a very fixed view. I knew what most people would say. And so I did, but I made myself write a piece. I did contribute. Because I thought it was wrong not to. I could easily have got out of it, but I thought it was morally wrong. What I said, of course, was immediately attacked by both sides, which happens to all my works. What I said roughly was that I did not believe in political crusades, military power used for political purposes, that therefore I did not approve the American anti-communist crusade in Vietnam, but on the other hand, I didn't want I thought massacres were worse than wars. And therefore, the idea of the Americans just leaving and telling the Vietnamese, very sorry, we can't go on, it's gone on too long. Just goodbye, look after yourselves as best you can, was betrayal. If Mr. Walter Lippmann, I said, the idea of the Americans occupying the ports was of preventing, allowing people to escape if they wanted to, or protecting them, was feasible, I'd be in favor of that, but clearly I didn't think it was. So, what I said roughly was that it's not a war I particularly approved of, but the idea of the Americans just getting out seemed to me to be a betrayal.